Today is Thursday, November 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, we take a deeper look into the ongoing protests in Iraq and Lebanon and where they may be headed next for the region.
Former Iranian President Abu Hassan Bani Sadr tells VOA the ongoing popular protests in both Iraq and Lebanon have made a shambles of nearly 40 years of policy by the Iranian regime.
Plus, the World Health Organization and the UN Children's Fund report up to 20% of children and adolescents under the age of 14 suffer from mental health disorders. Those stories and more next. At least four protesters were killed and more than 35 others wounded in central Baghdad Thursday after security forces used live gunfire to disperse anti-government demonstrations. That's according to police and hospital sources speaking to Reuters News. In addition, dozens of anti-government protesters blocked the entrance to Iraq's port of Umm Qasr just hours after operations had resumed, according to port officials. Anti-government unrest in Iraq that began in Baghdad over a lack of jobs and poor services has lasted for weeks and spread to southern cities, with more than 250 people being killed in a brutal crackdown by security forces. In Lebanon, protests against the ruling elite have plunged the country into political turmoil at a time of acute economic crises. The nationwide protests, which were ignited on October 17th by a government proposal to tax WhatsApp calls, led Saad al-Hariri to resign as prime minister last week. There has been no sign of progress toward agreement on a new government. The World Bank on Wednesday said it stood ready to back a new Lebanese government, warning the country has no time to waste to tackle the economic crisis that is worsening day by day. The bank called for the rapid formation of a new cabinet and said it expects a recession in 2019 to be even more significant than an earlier projection of a 0.2% contraction in the economy. Now, joining us on the phone right now to bring things down, to break things down further and where they may go in the future in Iraq and Lebanon, we're joined by Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst with Stratfor. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Emily, can in a nutshell, I know this is difficult because we're talking about two different countries with two different circumstances, but why are we seeing protests in Iraq and Lebanon at the same time?
Yeah, each country is different, but there are a couple similar drivers. I think there's poor economic sentiment and there's poor governance. And both countries have seen these drivers impact this unrest in somewhat similar ways. In terms of the economic sentiment, both Lebanon and Iraq have seen the floating of a potential austerity budget, especially in Lebanon, where we've seen new taxes being introduced. There's also significant economic inequality in Lebanon, some of the highest in the region. And you have in Iraq, Iraq is still unable to provide stable employment to most of its population, despite having some of the largest oil and gas reserves in the world. So there's that economic driver. And then the second driver that relates to that is really poor governance. The governing systems in both of these countries are complex. They were built to give every stakeholder in the country a voice, and they were built to resolve years of conflict. But those systems don't necessarily govern efficiently or effectively, and they really do set up an established elite that is difficult to change and difficult to it doesn't respond well to people's demands. So I think you're seeing those it's economic sentiment and it's poor governance.
So if we take a look, I guess stepping back from each individual country to the region, how are these events playing out over a larger field?
I think one of the opportunities but also risks of what's happening right now is that both these places, Iraq and Lebanon, are key governments that are of interest to the stronger Middle Eastern powers in the region, especially Iran, Saudi Arabia, and other Arab Gulf states, as well as Turkey. These countries have labor markets and cultural appeal and wealth and all different types of value to these countries. And when you have this kind of unrest, there is a potential for some sort of change to the political system. That means that all these external actors are going to be sort of recalibrating, reassessing how they can influence the political system within the country for their own advantage. So I do think that it does matter geopolitically for the region at large, if we actually see some sort of political shift or changes to the government system as a result of this unrest.
You're talking about both the economic side and the political side, but is one or the other easier to remedy, since we're talking in Lebanon about essentially the economy and policies there versus, you know, the drive in Iraq to get out the elites?
You know, on the one hand, it does seem simple. On the one hand, there's a lot of economic changes that, especially Lebanon, as you point to, they could make in order to satisfy what people are asking for. And really shore up the economy, stabilize it. The central bank in Lebanon has a lot of money. There is a lot of wealth in Lebanon. It's just very, very divided unequally. Iraq is a bit of a different story. There is a lot more poverty in Iraq, and they have significant security issues that Lebanon doesn't have. So there are some, it does seem like there should be some easy solutions, but it's going to require some of the entrenched elite politically and economically to be willing to give up some of the benefits that they have, to give up some of the political capital that they have. And that's the big question right now, is are they willing to give up some of what they have in order that the system might become a little bit more equal?
Emily Hawthorne is the Middle East and North Africa analyst with Stratfor. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said the United States is not fulfilling its pledge to remove a Kurdish militia from a Syrian border region, and he said he will raise that issue when he meets with U.S. President Donald Trump next week. A month ago, Turkey launched a cross-border offensive with Syrian rebels against Kurdish YPG fighters. After seizing control of a 120-kilometer-long swath of territory, it reached a deal with the United States to keep the Kurds out of the area. After the deal with Washington, Ankara also reached an agreement with Moscow under which the YPG was to withdraw to a depth of 30 kilometers along the entirety of the northeastern Syrian border with Turkey. VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch joins us via Skype with more. So, Heather, what can you tell us about the situation on the ground in Syria, since President Erdogan is saying that the United States isn't doing enough to uphold its end of the bargain to keep what it calls, you know, Kurdish YPG fighters and terrorists out of the so-called safe zone?
The YPG fighters have, for the most part, withdrawn from the area that they said they would, which is 30 kilometers from the border in most places. That doesn't include Kemeshli, which is one major urban area that is right on the border. But that wasn't part of the agreements between Russia and Turkey. There are other parts of the border that the YPG or the SDF maybe has not fully withdrawn from, because they are still controlling the areas that are with their border from with Iraq, if that makes any sense. The U.S. has been criticized by Turkey for not doing enough to make sure this happens. But at the same time, this comes right on the heels of the U.S. not physically actually withdrawing all their troops from Syria, but saying they were. So they also lost a lot of their ability to dictate what happens on the ground in those border towns, as they did actually physically leave the bases on a lot of the border towns as well.
Right, because they left and they've since been, you know, repositioned to guard the oil fields, according to the Pentagon. I wanted to also ask you, there have been some reports of skirmishes in the area since the ceasefires between the United States and Russia were brokered. What is the current situation in terms of fighting?
There is sporadic fighting on the ground between the Syrian National Army, formerly known as the Free Syrian Army, which is basically a rebel group from Syria that is now acting as a proxy for Turkey. So it's a Turkish-backed militant group that is now fighting with the Kurds and also a bit with the Syrian government, which has now joined the Kurds in terms of policing their borders. So some fighting is going on. There's been some battles. Some people continue to be killed, injured, and displaced. There's a lot of fear among the local people in northeastern Syria of the Syrian National Army. As much as Turkey calls the YPG a terrorist group, likens them to ISIS, says they have values as Islamic State militants do, local people in northeastern Syria, Kurds, believe this militant group, the Syrian National Army, is the same. and the stories that go around, some may be true, some may be not true, but they're everywhere. You'll hear stories of human rights violations and war crimes being committed. So the people themselves are terrified to go into areas that are occupied by Turkish-backed militants.
Speaking of people on the ground, when the fighting was initially taking place about a month ago, there was a lot of concern about humanitarian aid getting to those who needed it most. What actually happened? What did you see when you were there?
What started about a month ago has continued to unfold, and I think it's pretty much safe to say it is a Syria's latest humanitarian crisis. So far, about 300,000 people have fled their homes. And at the very beginning of the crisis, the international aid community evacuated the region. So there's an increasing amount of people day by day needing humanitarian aid. There's almost no aid workers or delivery systems left to bring in more aid. And winter is coming, and winter in Syria, for people that don't have homes and are living in tents, is very harsh. So, so far there's been no sign that this crisis is going to get any better or any help is on its way.
Heather Murdoch is VOA's Middle East correspondent and bureau chief. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Turkish officials had previously said Erdogan may call off his U.S. visit to protest a U.S. House of Representatives vote to recognize mass killings of Armenians a century ago as genocide and to seek sanctions on Turkey. China says Beijing and the U.S. will lift tariff hikes as trade talks advance. The AP's Charles de Ledesma has more.
A Chinese Commerce Ministry spokesman says envoys have agreed to a phased cancellation of tariff increases depending on the progress of negotiations. He told reporters that if both sides reach a first phase agreement, then based on that deal, they will cancel already imposed tariffs proportionally. The trade war has led to billions of dollars worth of punitive tariffs on each other's exports. China wants to have these roll back as part of a big trade agreement. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The solar system was anything but peaceful during and shortly after its formation 4.5 billion years ago. A new study from Rice University in Texas and China's Sun Yat-sen University suggests odd gravitational data gathered by NASA's Juno spacecraft may be explained by a massive head-on collision between a young Jupiter and a still-forming planet in the early solar system. The researchers say the Juno data indicates Jupiter's core is not as dense and is more extended than expected. The study suggests this massive collision could have mixed the dense contents of the core with less dense material in the layers that surrounded it. Study co-author Andrea Izzella, an astronomer at Rice, says leading theories of planet formation indicate Jupiter began as a dense, rocky, or icy planet and later gathered its thick atmosphere from the primordial disk of gas and dust that gave birth to our sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The World Health Organization and the UN Children's Fund report up to 20% of the children and adolescents under the age of 14 suffer from mental health disorders. The first ever conference aimed at exploring and tackling these problems opens Thursday in Florence, Italy. Lisa Schlein has those details.
WHO and UNICEF report up to 20% of adolescents globally experience mental health disorders, with half of these conditions starting before age 14. They note most of these cases are undetected and untreated. This, they warn, is resulting in alarmingly high rates of self-harm, suicide, and anxiety. Chiara Savili, a technician in WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, tells VOA this crisis has no borders. She says children in both low- and high-income countries face depression, anxiety, and emotional distress. She notes the majority of young people live in developing countries,
where they may be exposed to a range of risk factors like poverty or chronic conditions, including HIV, or migration and displacement, and violence. And these are all risk factors that have an influence on the psychosocial well-being of young people.
She says adolescents living in richer countries also have to contend with violence. They face stresses related to unstable families, bullying at school and social media, and a wide range of other difficult conditions. WHO reports depression is one of the leading global causes of illness and disability among adolescents. It says suicide is the third leading cause of death in adolescents between ages 15 and 19. Servilli says the stigma and shame attached to mental illness are major barriers to getting young people the help they need.
The lack of awareness about mental health means that both parents as well as families and teachers and adolescents, they do not recognize their experiences as related to mental health conditions. The other big challenge is in relation to the availability of care providers and trained human resources.
Servilli warns mental conditions that go untreated have serious short and long-term health consequences for adolescents. The inability to deal with their problems, she says, often pushes young people into alcohol and drug use, unsafe sexual and reproductive practices, violence, and other risky behaviors. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
North Korea on Thursday called Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe an idiot after he criticized a recent weapons test by North Korea. North Korea also criticized the United States after Washington announced it would resume combined aerial exercises with South Korea in December. Iran alleged Thursday that the UN inspector it blocked from a nuclear test site last week tested positive for suspected traces of explosive nitrates. The UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, said it disputed Iran's account without elaborating. The 39 people who were found dead in the back of a refrigerated truck after being smuggled into Britain last month all came from Vietnam and have now been formally identified. The driver of the truck has been charged with 39 counts of manslaughter, conspiracy to traffic people, and money laundering. Nearly two dozen people went on trial Wednesday in the French city of Lyon for what activists say is an all-too-common reality in Europe, allegations of forced prostitution involving migrant women. Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
The 23 defendants face up to 10 years in prison if found guilty of a slew of charges, ranging from money laundering to human slavery. They are suspected of running a sex trafficking ring that turned Nigerian women hoping for better lives in Europe into sexual slaves. Among them, a Nigerian pastor accused of being the ringleader and a woman suspected of recruiting Nigerian women as prostitutes in Lyon and two other French cities. She is on the run and being tried in absentia. Prosecutors say the 17 alleged victims earned about $160,000 a month for their master selling cheap sex. Most came from the same area, Benin City, in southern Nigeria, a pattern experts say seen in Italy and elsewhere in Europe.
It's a business and there is money. Nigerians, at the moment, are one of the most efficient traffickers.
Hélène de Rugy is a senior member of French NGO L'Amicale du Nid, which joined the prostitutes as a plaintiff in the case. Most of the sex workers stayed away from the trial for fear of reprisals, something de Rugy said happened last year during a similar sex trial in Lyon. Police say Nigerians make up a large portion of France's prostitute population. De Rugy says it reflects a wider European phenomenon, although it's hard to put exact figures to its size.
Victims are transported from one country to another, and we even meet victims who don't know in which country they are.
De Rugy says France must do more to crack down on prostitution and protect the victims. So must Nigerian authorities, she says, by stepping up the fight against female trafficking at home. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
On Saturday, Germany celebrates the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Built in 1961, the communist government of East Germany. The wall was meant to stop the flood of citizens fleeing into the West, but as Henry Ridgewell reports from Berlin, hopes that would bring about peace between the East and the West have crumbled as fears of a new Cold War began.
A giant wave holding aloft the hopes and memories of a people once divided by the Berlin Wall. 30,000 handwritten messages hang in front of the Brandenburg Gate. It was here, in June 1987, that then US President Ronald Reagan uttered this now famous demand to his Soviet counterpart.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
2 years after President Reagan's speech, Germans themselves would tear down the wall in a dramatic show of people power that would have profound consequences for Germany, for Europe, and for the global order. In the Soviet bloc, pressure had been building for months. Pro-democracy protests spread to East Germany. On November 9th, an East German government spokesman said citizens were now free to travel to the West. The shock announcement was a bureaucratic slip, but East Germans flocked to the border. In the confusion, guards opened the gates. Patrick Hartwig, then 19 years old, was among the first through. He went immediately to the Kurfürstendamm, a shopping district symbolic of Western capitalism. He now works in the very same street.
Dann habe ich die ganze Nacht da am Kudamm, ich habe auf irgendeinem BMW gesessen.
I spent the whole night on the Kurfürstendamm. I was sitting in a random BMW, a bottle of sparkling wine in my hand, and we honked up and down the Kurfürstendamm and had a wild night. 30 years later, I still think the changes were positive. It was a peaceful change.
The events of that night echoed across the world. A few weeks later, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and new US President George Bush announced the Cold War was over.
It seemed as if things were getting more peaceful, that the world was getting to a more peaceful place. Some even said this was the end of history.
By 1991, the Soviet Union had crumbled. But in the 3 decades since, tensions between East and West have reemerged.
NATO has taken in Poland, the Baltic states, and so on, have seen this as a threat. Although, of course, it wasn't meant as a threat. It wasn't an aggressive NATO which sort of had a drive to the East, but it was the East European countries who applied for NATO membership.
As the new century dawned, Vladimir Putin emerged as Russia's strongman, pledging to rebuild the country's pride and power. In Moscow, the events of 1989 are viewed very differently 3 decades on.
Gorbachev was is now much less accepted than he was then, because he is now seen not only as the person who gave away the GDR, but also as the person who destroyed the Soviet Union. And Putin is, I think, essentially trying to regain part of this Soviet hegemonic position in Europe.
In 2014, Russia forcefully seized Crimea and supported pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Relations between East and West have plunged. Russia and the United States are rearming. Moscow blames the West for missed opportunities.
It could have been a win-win situation, but for that, the Western countries should have been much wiser.
Germans and visitors from around the world will celebrate the anniversary Saturday, the night freedom came to Berlin. But peace between East and West has remained elusive. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Berlin.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Patrick Daya, and managing editor, Paul Alexander, thank you very much for joining us today. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at their VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.